Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. According to New America Foundation data, the CIA inaugurated its drone program in Yemen on November 3, 2002, when a missile was launched remotely, killing six terrorist suspects, including Al-Qaeda's top operative in Yemen and U.S. citizen Kamal Derwish. The covert U.S. drone program, which began under former President Bush, has dramatically increased under President Obama. Since Obama took office, about 300 drone strikes have killed an estimated 2,500 people, including civilians not targeted in the attacks, according to a New York Times investigation. Even though the U.S. military still uses traditional aircrafts, helicopters, and cruise missiles to assassinate alleged terrorists, drones are becoming the weapon of choice for going after suspected threats to U.S. security in places like Pakistan, Yemen, or Somalia. Drone strikes are popular with Americans, but they generate widespread anger in the places where they're frequently used. In fact, the secret drone program has generated harsh criticism from those who point to an increase in the number of civilian casualties. So what are the ethical, strategic, political, and legal implications of these drone strikes? And what precedents does the U.S. drone program set globally? Would you still support drone attacks if other countries had the ability to kill people they considered terrorists living in your neighborhood? Well, to sort all of this out, we're joined by Alice Roths. She is a writer at the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which has conducted a major investigation into the U.S. drone program. She joins us from London. Hi, Alice.
Hi, good morning, Holly.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're also joined by Noreen Shaw, who is director of the Human Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. Hi, Noreen.
Hi.
So let's start off with you, Noreen. We're talking about drones that are used in targeted assassination. I'm wondering what actually happens. So for those of us who have never experienced it, like me, it sounds very high-tech. These unmanned air missiles take off from bases in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan, and they're controlled from the U.S. So can you explain how this all actually works?
Sure. Well, we know that the United States has bases in different parts of our country. In Nevada, there's also control rooms on the East Coast. So there's a lot of people involved. There's maybe, you know, for a U.S. military operation, there might be 100 people involved in a kind of control room. And then there's a drone operator, a pilot, and a sensor operator. And they are controlling this aircraft that's, you know, thousands of miles away in another country. And that aircraft might have taken off from a base in that country. And it's, of course, all done remotely. There might be contractors. There might be citizens of another country that are involved in helping us maintain our bases in that other country and get that airplane off the ground. But the U.S. personnel are in the United States. The plane is in another country. And the question is, who's on the ground from the United States? Who's reliable on the ground? Who's helping us eyeball exactly who we're killing, who we're targeting? We don't have a lot of information about that, but what we do know is somewhat troubling that, you know, typically in a normal military operation, it would be U.S. Marines on the ground. It would be, you know, even CIA officers on the ground being able to get a sense of who that person is that we're targeting. But with drone operations, we're often relying on video surveillance and then some other kinds of corroboration that might be pretty weak. And that's what makes people really pause and think about how accurate and how precise drone strikes really are.
So who are the people, these 2,000 to 3,000 people who've been killed by these drones?
Well, we don't really know. And I think like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, a lot of other media organizations have been trying to figure that out. But it's actually very difficult to know who's being killed, because it's hard to get to the places where drone strikes are occurring. It's hard for Pakistani journalists, let alone international journalists, to get to those places. They're volatile regions, and there's mixed stories coming out. I mean, both the Pakistani government, the U.S. government, and the militant groups operating in those areas, they all have an interest in telling a particular story about who is being killed, and it's really hard to independently verify what's actually happening. And some journalists have been able to do it, but we don't have on a large scale, really all of the information that we need to find out. And what would be ideal is if the U.S. government came out and said, well, we've heard allegations that people are being killed. We did an investigation. We sent in our own soldiers, our own investigators, and this is what we found. But the U.S. government has never done that when it comes to Pakistan, Yemen, or Somalia.
Though they do admit to having this covert drone program.
They admit to carrying out drone strikes, and John Brennan, who's the chief counterterrorism advisor for the Obama administration, in May, thanks in part to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's reporting, in May John Brennan came out and admitted that there have been civilian casualties from drone strikes. He said they were extremely rare, and he said that when they happened, they gave the administration a lot of pause. But what he didn't say is that any apologies are ever made, that the dignity of these people is recognized, that any compensation is provided. And that's a real difference between the way the United States carries out attacks in other countries, even in neighboring Afghanistan. You know, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture of what the U.S. military has done in that country at all, but there is a difference for a victim of U.S. Military strikes in Afghanistan, they might get some kind of compensation. They might have some redress. In Pakistan, that just will never happen.
Alice, you just put out this big report that has a lot of data in it. I think it says that from June 2004 through mid-September 2012, drone strikes killed between 2,562 to 3,325 people in Pakistan, of whom 474 to 881 were civilians, including 176 children. Can you tell us about this big study and what you found about who's being targeted and who's actually being killed in these drone attacks?
Absolutely. So we've actually spent around 18 months looking at drone strikes in Pakistan, and it's a piece of work that we've really been putting out as we go. So last July we published research showing that these drone strikes were occurring, and that the claims made by Obama's counterterrorism director John Brennan that no civilians had been killed in drone strikes for the previous year were actually untrue. We published details of 10 strikes which appeared to show civilian casualties. So what we've been doing is we've been looking at all the various press reports that occur whenever there is a strike. So there'll be press reports in the local media. Sometimes there'll be press reports in the US or the international media. And they often conflict each other because it's very, very hard for reporters to get into Waziristan. So you often have a mass of sort of contradictory, sometimes conflicting information. And we simply record in the most transparent fashion that we can what all those different sources are saying. And from that, we've come up with this tally, which shows that that quite significant numbers of civilians do appear to be being killed, along with a large quantity of people where we don't know. We're often told by anonymous officials that these people are so-called militants, but it's not clear often who they're fighting for. It's quite rare, actually, for militants to be named in reports. So, I mean, for the vast bulk of these people, we just don't know who they are.
But the reports that have come out, people who have done studies that was all featured in your big report, seem to be saying that use of drones, advocates of these unmanned missiles, say that these targeted killings are much better than traditional warfare in terms of civilian casualties.
Well, I mean, the simple fact is that we don't know. We don't have the official information to assess whether the people who are dying are militants or are civilians. So in the absence of official information, we're stuck with fragmentary and often conflicting press reports from a region where it's very difficult to get first-hand reporting. So, I mean, until we have official sources of information, and actually Noreen has just put out an extremely good report calling on the government to account for its own drone program, because until we have those official sources of information to compare to all these press reports, we can't say whether it's more effective or more efficient than a traditional war. The other factor is that Pakistan, as an ally of the U.S., is not a traditional battleground. It would not be possible for the U.S. to launch a traditional war. So it's not really a valid comparison to compare it to a traditional war such as Afghanistan.
In your report, Alice, you wrote, even if drone operations outside of traditional conflict zones are found to be legal and to result in relatively few civilian casualties, the authors of this report would nevertheless be concerned with the long-term impact of such operations on the civilian population and the precedent-setting nature of these operations, accountability for the CIA and JSOC's actions, and the inherent limitations these operations to properly address civilian harm. So what do you think should be done differently?
Well, I mean, for a start, we do need increased accountability and increased transparency from the operation. I'm not sure whether that's actually our report. That sounds to me like the Columbia University report. That may be Noreen's report.
Noreen, sorry, yeah, I think that might have been yours.
That's our report. I mean, what we think needs to be done is first the U.S. government has to come out acknowledging that these operations are not infallible. The biggest problem is that President Obama, from him all the way down, every member of the U.S. government proclaims drone strikes to be a kind of panacea for war, denying that, you know, when we go to war with drones, we're still going to war. And the same ills that follow war when we have boots on the ground will also follow us when we go into a country with drone strikes. And that includes terrorizing the population and also putting ourselves out on the world stage as an aggressor. Now, we might have, you know, the Obama administration has reasons for conducting these strikes in Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia. They can have those justifications, but it's unfair for them to say that drone strikes are the most precise and most humane form of warfare, while also denying us access to any data that would make it possible for us to verify whether that's true. It's also the case that the Obama administration gets to talk the talk of being anti-war. President Obama gets to talk about withdrawing troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, and at the same time, he's expanding our combat operations and a lot of theaters around the world that I would guess that most people don't even know about.
And
he's not going on primetime TV to announce, tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I have sent drones into Yemen, not the way he would if it was Iraq or Afghanistan. So in a way, drones are letting us shortcut and circumvent public opinion in this country that President Bush never could do because the technology wasn't there. He had to admit that he was going to war in Iraq, and we had a lot more public debate about it than we've ever seen about drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen.
And that's Noreen Shah. She is the director of the Human Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. We're also joined by Alice Ross, who's a writer at the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and they both put out major investigations into the U.S. drone program, which is what we're talking about. I'm Holly Kern, and this is Your Call. And I want to invite our listeners to weigh in on the ethical, legal, and political implications of this covert drone program. The number to call is 1-866-798-8255. Do you think drones are a justifiable weapon? Should there be international policy around the use of drones for assassination, or is that always unacceptable? And is the alternative traditional warfare? 1-866-798-8255 is the number to join our conversation on Your Call. Are our policies working? Officials say targeted assassination has decimated al-Qaeda. Critics say it's counterproductive. So what changes do you want to see about U.S. drone policy? And what should be secret and what should be out in the open for public debate, as our guest just brought up? The number again is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Talk. And let me go back to you, Noreen and Alice, and let's talk about the Obama use of the drone program, which is has increased extremely a lot since he became president. Now, they also say that they've tightened the standards and that the president himself actually okays many of these drone strikes. Can you just tell us about the Obama administration's policy around these covert drones?
Is that question directed to me?
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, for a very long time, there's been very little written, revealed in public about the Obama administration's use of drones. So for the first, I'd say, 2 years of Obama's presidency, you would get anonymous CIA officials confirming strikes had taken place to newspapers and to reporters, but there was no official line on the drone strikes. And it wasn't until John Brennan of John Brennan referred to drone strikes, saying that they were a surgical tool in June 2011, that the administration started to really discuss its policies towards drone strikes. And even then, it has been very piecemeal. So there'll be a comment here and a comment there in the public about the administration's policies. Now, in January this year, President Obama finally commented on the drone program, and that was as part of an online town hall debate. But it wasn't until September this year that he actually laid out his own five rules for drone strikes in public. And what he said is that it has to be a target that's authorized by our laws. It has to be a threat that's serious and not speculative. It has to be a situation in which we can't capture the individual before they move forward on some sort of operational plot against the United States. Number four is we've got to make sure in whatever operations we conduct, we're very careful about avoiding civilian casualties. And number five is that while there is a legal justification for us to try and stop American citizens from carrying out plots, they're subject to the protections of the Constitution and to due process. Now, this comments like this and increasingly in-depth reporting from organizations like the New York Times and from the Washington Post on how they're picking targets and Obama's personal involvement in approving targets is a commendable step towards increased transparency. But actually, we can't weigh up his categories for deciding whether it is a serious and not speculative threat, for example, or deciding whether they're being successful in avoiding civilian casualties while this policy, while this program still remains largely in the shadows. So, I mean, over the past 6 months, we have seen an increasing move towards more official discussion of the drone program, but there's still a very long way to go. I mean, obviously, it is a CIA program. It's never going to be completely transparent, and in counterterrorism, there's always going to be an element of opaque behavior. But so we are seeing it starting to move out of the shadows somewhat. But I'd say there's still a very long way to go before we have the kind of transparency that allows us to evaluate whether Obama's five rules are being followed by the administration itself.
And that's Alice Ross, who's a writer at the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the U.S. covert drone program abroad. We're also joined by Naureen Shah, who's director of the Human Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. And now we're joined by John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
So we were just talking about the Obama administration and its increasing use of drones. You talk about the evolution of counterterrorism in the U.S. from Bush to Obama. Can you tell us about how that's evolved?
Sure. Well, first, it's important to point out that the two kind of key programs that the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration during this handover period, George W. Bush pleaded with his successor to maintain these two programs, namely drones, and the second was the covert operation against Iran through computer viruses. And not only did President Obama keep to his word on that, but he dramatically expanded the drone program. And drones became, in some sense, a kind of, and I say this relatively speaking, a low-intensity way to maintain the kind of war on terrorism that the Bush administration pioneered after 9/11. And I say low intensity because, in some sense, what the Obama administration wanted to do was extract some of the key elements of that program and avoid the kind of criticism, not only domestically but internationally, that counterterrorism programs encountered during the Bush administration. Number one was, of course, extraordinary rendition. In other words, the capture of individuals, of suspects, and their transfer to a third country where they could be tortured and where they were tortured, something that that came under intense criticism here in the United States and internationally. Drone attacks.
And John, just to clarify, the extraordinary rendition is still happening.
It is, but not in the same at the same levels. And we should remember that extraordinary rendition wasn't an innovation of the Bush administration. It was actually introduced by the Clinton administration, but it was something that the Bush administration increasingly relied on, and also through its manipulation of legal doctrine emphasized the role of torture and the usefulness, utility of torture through extraordinary rendition. But under the Obama administration, drones really have become the centerpiece. And they've become the centerpiece both in Pakistan, but as I'm sure your other guests have been explaining, has spread to other parts of the world as well, to Yemen, to Somalia, and elsewhere. So we've seen, in other words, key features of the war on terror preserved by the Obama administration, even though the administration has, of course, retired that exact phrase and tried to distance itself conceptually and legally from the actions of the Bush administration.
And now, as I understand it, Noreen, the administration, according to the New York Times, is trying to develop explicit rules for the targeted killing of so-called terrorists by unmanned drones. What do you know about how they're going about trying to develop this set of rules?
Well, remarkably little, other than what we read about in the New York Times, and I would say that that's the problem. This administration does try to distance itself from the Bush administration by talking about the rule of law and due process. But when they talk about due process, they're talking about a non-judicial due process, and they're also talking about decision-making that happens internally within the executive branch. That necessarily means that people like myself who want to engage with the administration about their decision-making processes are kept at arm's length. We're not talking about a checks and balances system where there's an executive action, there's some amount of judicial review, there's congressional oversight, and there's oversight by human rights and civil liberties watchdogs. We're talking about an ongoing campaign of airstrikes, which is really run internally by the Joint Special Operations Command, by the CIA, by people within the White House, that is really outside of public scrutiny. And whatever rules they are writing, they're not asking anyone outside of those groups whether those rules are really the sufficient rules. And I'll give you a really specific example. They talk so much in media, in leaks, the CIA and other officials, senior officials in the U.S. government frequently talk about civilian casualties. They know it's a problem, but they downplay it. They say that it's not happening, it's happening in the rarest of circumstances. And because they really believe that, and because they discount reporting, like their Bureau of Investigative Journalism's reporting, they haven't apparently put into place any mechanisms to investigate on the ground what happens after a drone strike. There's no mechanisms that would be in other situations recommended by, for instance, the International Committee of the Red Cross, recommended by the UN, to go in, talk to witnesses, gather forensic evidence that shows who is being killed, for what reasons, at what time of the day, and that would then lead to a system, a process of compensating people, recognizing what's happened to them. Because people within the administration don't think civilian casualties are a major problem, we don't think that they're putting into place those kinds of systems that we would be asking for if they would come out and talk about this and engage with civil society on the issue.
And we just have about a minute before the break, but some people are saying, putting aside the ethical implications of using unmanned drones, the strategy may be backfiring in Yemen and Pakistan. What do you think of that? Does anybody want to?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I'll just say this, that, you know, We hear a lot about what's productive and what's not productive. The U.S. government always has more information than even the best of analysts. The question really is, would we be going into these places and conducting these kinds of strikes if it wasn't for drone technology? I think a lot can be said about the capability of drone technology to be more accurate and more precise and to be better than having boots on the ground and causing less civilian damage. But would we even be going and conducting these kinds of wars if it wasn't for drone technology's kind of invisibility, for the ability of the Obama administration to kind of fly below the radar with this? And as a democratic country, we have to think, you know, if we weren't willing to do this out in the open, should we be willing to do it secretly?
And
I think that's the bigger moral question.
And we'll pick up on that question. Noreen Shah is director of the clinic, the Human Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. We're also joined by Alice Ross, who's with the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and John Pfeffer, who's co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're talking about the political, ethical, and legal implications of current covert targeted assassination policy using unmanned drones, and we'll take your calls after the break. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and we will be right back after this short break.
Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a show that depends on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's show. It's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter, yourcallradio.org. Click the link that says email newsletter.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. You can sign up for our newsletter or send us a show idea to yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, our topic is the future of museums. A budding movement hopes to turn museums into relevant and participatory spaces. So how do we make our museums more dynamic and essential resources? And what's the value of a traditional museum? That's tomorrow on Your Call. Today, we're talking about the political, ethical, and legal implications of current covert targeted assassination policy using unmanned drones. Are our policies working? Officials say targeted assassination has decimated al-Qaeda. Critics say it's counterproductive and extra legal. So should there be international policy around the use of drones for assassination? Or is that always unacceptable? We have full lines. I'll give out the number in another minute. I want to get to a lot of these emails and phone calls. But first, there is a UN special a commissioner who is going to establish an investigative unit early next year in Geneva to probe these drone attacks internationally. What do we know about kind of international law around these areas? Should we go to you, Alice, or Noreen?
I would say Noreen is probably the expert on this.
Yeah, Noreen, what's happening with that Geneva probe, and what are the international legal implications of this?
Well, the Geneva probe is a UN expert who's going to be investigating drone strikes. Now, it's not the first time that the UN has looked to step into this issue. There was a report issued in May 2010 by the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings that really pushed a lot of people, I think, in the Obama administration, want to come out and defend the policy of targeted killings. So what we see usually is that after one of these reports, while they're able to provide some information and really raise some important issues, the CIA and some people in the administration in leaks explain a little bit more about what's happening. And I think that this administration feels a lot of pressure already internationally. This report will add to it a lot of pressure to explain and justify what it's doing, even if it continues in litigation to say this is a covert program, we can't talk about it, which is actually the position of the CIA still in a lawsuit that it's facing from the ACLU. At least the Obama administration will have to come out and explain a little bit more about what it's doing. I think the administration also feels some amount of pressure because it knows it's setting a precedent. And in a way, it's a legal precedent, and it's also a moral precedent. There are tons of other countries that are acquiring drone technology. This isn't something that's going to be among the U.S. and the U.K. and France. It's not like nuclear weapons. It's a rapidly proliferating technology, partly because we and Israel are exporting it to other countries. And as those other countries get the technology, the question is, does somehow drone technology fall outside of the normal rules, the normal laws that govern any kind of warfare? And definitively, the answer is no. Drone technology is just a weapons platform. It's no different in terms of assessing whether or not we're allowed to do it under international laws of war and under international human rights law. Now, the legal implications are complicated, and it depends on whether or not we're conducting these strikes in Yemen or Somalia and Pakistan. It depends on how much consent what we have from those countries, and it also depends on whether or not we're facing an imminent threat of a terrorist attack from the groups that we are fighting against. The biggest problem is that the administration talks about how we are facing a threat from al-Qaeda and its affiliates, but what exactly an affiliate is and who really is a member of those groups is really in a lot of dispute. It is an individual who is carrying a gun, who's in a part of northwest Pakistan. Is he necessarily a legitimate target under the laws of war or under international human rights law? It really depends on who he is. But what we see from the Obama administration is an assertion that it doesn't depend on who he is. They're going to count that person as a militant as long as he is a military-age male. And I think that's what makes people really nervous, that there should be a kind of scrutiny, there should be caution about who we're killing in the name of the war on terrorism. We would expect that of the Obama administration, given its commitments to human rights and to the rule of law. And we're not seeing that in what it says about who it's deciding to kill.
And we've got a lot of callers. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about unmanned drones used in assassination. Let's go to Raul in Nevada. Hi, Raul.
Hi. I'm glad you're having a talk about this today and your other program coming up next week about domestic use. But I just have to say that this is there are no good sides to this. There is no good side to the drone technology. It gives us a kind of detachment from reality, and I think we're going to see the consequences somewhere down the road, and it'll be like 9/11 again, and we're constantly in this churning of our reality where, I don't know, we're just, it's not the country that I grew up loving. So anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you, Raul. Let me read a couple of emails that have questions. This is from Art in San Francisco, Art Persico. The use of drones to track people inside and outside of our country is an extremely dangerous development, and the use of drones should be resisted everywhere, including in Alameda County. The hysteria created by the war on terrorism is damaging our national commitment to constitutional rights and has resulted in using drones not only for surveillance domestically, but also for international extrajudicial killing of those deemed terrorists, even American citizen. Combine the use of drones with that lack of due process and indefinite detention allowed by the NDAA, which is going through Congress right now, and you have a toxic stew that undermines our civil liberties and decrees death without due process. So what does your panel say about what we in the Bay Area and Northern California and the Santa Cruz area should do to push back against this? Anybody? Noreen, what do you say about what we as citizens should be doing?
Well, you know, I think that the Obama administration doesn't feel like there is a lot of public pressure on it. There's pressure maybe from academics, there's pressure from people like me, there's pressure from the international community. Drones are wildly unpopular in different parts of the world, but within the United States, I mean, we only saw drones come up in one of the presidential debates, and even the moderator didn't put the question to Obama. He put it to Governor Romney. So we never heard a word from President Obama about drones during any of the presidential debates, and we haven't seen him really have to personally answer for what's going on in any kind of aggressive or critical space. So I think that it is a matter of people writing letters to the editor in local newspapers and really starting to go out on the street and you know, raise these questions in public dialogues to make it seem like this is a real issue. But I don't think people will do that until they really know what's happening on the ground. And again, it goes back to government secrecy, that if we're not seeing, you know, exposés and reports in mainstream U.S. media about how people being killed in drone strikes, about the role of the CIA, then we're not going to have an informed public, and we're not going to see any kind of mass movement demanding answers from the U.S. government on this.
And
I can add as well, I think it's actually quite important that people understand who is more about who is being killed by these drone strikes. You know, I mean, the perception in the United States does seem to be very much that it's all Al-Qaeda terrorists, and by implication that the people who are being killed are all planning immediate terror attacks on the United States. And actually, we don't have very much information on whether that's the case or not. So it's about people really demanding more accountability about who is actually being killed and understanding a little bit more about who is being killed.
Demanding accountability and more answers about what's actually happening. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join us at 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who is a proponent of this technology, of this drone technology, if you think it's an alternative to traditional warfare, we'd love to hear from you. What is your perspective on the use of drones? 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. eliminate talk? And would you still support drone attacks if other countries had the ability to kill people they considered terrorists living in your neighborhood? 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. And let's go to Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Hi, good morning. You know, far more innocent people getting killed by the drone. A couple of months ago, 80 Yemenis. And just imagine if you live in the United States and another country does that to us, how anybody feels secure. The second thing is that whole thing is part of the so-called war on terror, which is totally artificial. Al-Qaeda is a bunch of nobodies whatsoever, hardly anybody left of them. And what we're actually doing, we're recruiting more people by being so angry at the United States, by killing innocent people. And you also have to consider the second attacks when funeral or people trying to pick up the body parts from the first attack, then another drone come and kill more people. I just like to say that Obama have been so much disappointing. He have been far worse than George W. Bush and for all people who voted for him. And of course, nobody should have voted for Romney either. This man have a total disappointment. He is following Byrne, who is a new con, is a new con policy that just is nothing but to attack and destroy Muslims and other people across the whole world. And no way was this drone be used against European country like England or any other country in Europe. So the whole thing is really disgusting and bloody. And guess what? Very easy to make drones. So how do we know how we're going to secure ourselves in the United States from other countries attacking us with drones?
Can I ask you a question, Eid? Are you somebody who consumes foreign language media or international media?
Yes.
How are these drone strikes covered in other places outside of the U.S.?
Very bad, extremely bad. Not just even foreign media, I mean, you know, Arabic speaking like mine, but even just international media. It is looked at terribly bad. And you know what Obama have done to this country have been so disgusting. The money he spent on the wars and everything, he is far worse than Bush. And guess what? He is going to give in this fiscal cliff. It is a game between him and the Republican to destroy Social Security and Medicare and the rest of it. He's a terrible man, and I'm really very disappointed at him.
Thanks for your call. Well, let me bring up this fiscal cliff question with John Pfeffer. But first, I want to let you know that next Wednesday, that's a week from today, we'll be talking about the domestic use of drones. So that is next Wednesday. Today, we're discussing international use of drones for targeted assassination. And John, just brought up this so-called fiscal cliff. So let's talk a little bit about the economics of the drone program. Supposedly, it's a lot cheaper with cuts to the Pentagon budget. What does that mean for the drone program?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, relatively speaking, drones are cheaper than, say, an aircraft carrier or your latest joint strike fighter, which are extraordinarily expensive, big-ticket items. Right now, the president has proposed something like $500 billion in cuts in military spending over 10 years. That is before we come to the fiscal cliff, before the possibility of sequestration. If sequestration goes through, we're talking about an automatic cut on top of that on military spending that would amount to approximately $1 trillion over 10 years. And that's something that Republicans in particular, but plenty of Democrats don't want to see either. But in either scenario, we're looking at a period of relative austerity for the Pentagon. Of course, Pentagon spending is still, you know, enormous and will be enormous even when these cuts go through. But for the first time in a long time, Pentagon has to take a look at the bottom line and make some cuts. And in a period like that, where they're forced to knock off some of the big ticket items, when they have to look at the costs of boots on the ground, where they're looking for savings from bringing troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan, drones become a much, much more attractive option from a financial point of view. So that's the kind of general economic situation.
And that's...
Can I just add something about that? Because I think it's a little bit of a misconception about, you know, this idea of cost savings from drones. Your drone itself, if you consider the cost of that, that might be a cost saving. But we're also talking about all of the other people who are involved in a ground control station, the dedicated ground components. And I've seen estimates that each drone is 30 $6.2 million in terms of a Reaper drone and the ground equipment and the operation. The U.S. has said that it's planning to spend about $32 billion on drones over the next 8 years. So we are talking about a pretty substantial amount of money. And in terms of thinking about this industry, about not just U.S. government accountability, but also about corporate accountability, we have to consider that this is a huge market already for the you know, defense industry. It's going to rise from $5.9 billion to $11.3 billion in the next decade. So drones are not necessarily the cheap option. And in a way, they also are enabling us to continue to do military operations in countries where we might otherwise be adopting a preventive or diplomatic-focused kind of approach because we don't want to do another land war. So I just want to pause on that and say it's kind of a misconception to say that this is going to save us money in any kind of way.
And that's Noreen. Go ahead, John.
I would add that, you know, it's true that drones are much more expensive than they've often been billed. But when you compare it to what the Air Force has generally been projecting as its costs over the next 10 years, that's where, you know, it looks relatively cheaper because increasingly the Air Force is looking at a situation where they're not going to be spending any money on these very sophisticated jet fighters, which cost upwards of $200 million apiece, and they're going to rely increasingly on drones. Overall, including the larger chain of operations behind the drones, yeah, I don't think it's actually going to save money at all. But from the narrow perspective of the Pentagon, they see it as cost saving. And from the narrow perspective of the Obama administration, when it has to kind of make the case for Pentagon spending in Congress, drones appears as the cheaper alternative.
And that's John Pfeffer. He's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. You just heard from Noreen Shah, who is the director of the Human Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. We're also joined by Alice Ross with the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And we're talking about the international use of drones for targeted assassination. Next Wednesday, we will also be talking about the domestic use of drones inside of the United States. And let me go to an email. This is from David in San Francisco, and he writes, "The use of drones to target people for any purpose is antithetical to democracy and freedom. The use of drones to kill people is murder. The CIA is the main user and supporter of drone warfare and is a law unto itself. You can't have a free and democratic country anywhere in the world if the CIA can use drones to kill whoever they please. The CIA is secretly funded and operates in secret, so how are you going to control them if they decide to spy on and kill Americans?" Is there anybody who wants to respond to David before I go to more calls?
Well, indeed. I mean, there have been incidents when the CIA does appear to have killed American citizens overseas using the drone program. In fact, the very first person to be killed, I think you mentioned at the start of the program,
right,
was a U.S. citizen. So you get into these very severe questions whereby, and just to add to that as well, last year, Anwar al-Awlaki, who was also a U.S. citizen, he was killed by a U.S. drone in Yemen. And then a week later, his U.S.-born son was also killed by a U.S. drone in Yemen. So you get into these very, very difficult questions around extrajudicial killings, the secrecy of the CIA, the sheer opaqueness of the entire operation just remains highly problematic. Your correspondent is right.
And let's go to Eileen in Mountain View. Eileen, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm wondering if John or Alice or Noreen can tell me how much each of these drones cost. I read someplace on the internet that the drone Predator Tier 2 costs $4 million, and if we use a lot of those, that'll use up that budget pretty fast. I'm horrified by this program. We've turned from the good guys into the Empire Strikes Back, so... Thank you for your program, and I'll take my answer off the air.
So the actual economic cost. John? Noreen?
Yeah, well, I think Noreen already mentioned the ceiling cost of approximately $30 million. I mean, they could... of course, the Pentagon expects, through the development of this program, that they'll drive the cost down. And unfortunately, we're seeing more competition. As you pointed out, Israel, a leading exporter of drones. We're seeing Next Technology, smaller drones that can stay up in the air longer. And they want these to cost less and less money. So that we're going to have to deal with this economic question at some point where, you know, we can no longer, you know, say, look, this is appropriate because it's cheaper. We have to nail down this ethical question, the legal question, the counterproductivity of it, and to a certain extent bracket off the question of cost.
Yeah, if I can just add, I mean, one thing to clarify here is, for at least from my perspective, and I know, you know, a lot of people think this, I mean, drone technology is here to stay. And really, a lot of the questions and concerns we raise about drone technology are not so much about drone technology itself, but about the decision of the Obama administration to use this technology in lieu of other kinds of approaches, and also to really elevate the CIA and also the Joint Special Operations Command, which is a highly secretive organization within the U.S. military, to make them the ones that really are using this technology secretly in a lot of different places around the world. Drone technology itself, you know, it's an advance in technology in the same way. Not to trivialize the human cost to drone strikes, but it's in the same way as any technological advance. And when it happens, it's happening. There's no way to pull it back. It's not like anyone's going to put this gun back in the drawer and lock it. It's here, but the question is, how is it going to be used and how frequently is it going to be used? Now, you know, I just want to address another thing about the CIA. It is a secretive organization regarding the public, but we have to also reckon with how much Congress has bought into this program and how much of what is happening on the watch of people who we would ordinarily want to trust to be looking out for the interests of the American public. It's the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee. It's their job to be watching what the CIA does, and this is not a situation where the CIA is hiding the ball from them. It's not like what happened with some of the torture scandals where members of Congress could say afterwards, oh, CIA never briefed us. We had no idea it was happening. I think people need to understand that the congressional committees are being briefed on the CIA's activities. The CIA is very forthcoming with some policymakers on Capitol Hill and some people within the White House. It's just that there's political buy-in. This is a politically popular thing to do. There's oversight being done here, but it's not a critical kind of oversight. It's just a yes, continue doing that. You're doing a good job.
Okay, so I want to hear from somebody who believes that this is a good thing to be doing, because you mentioned that it's politically popular. Let's go to Steve in Aptos. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I think drone strikes are a terrible thing, but I think they're also a very preferable alternative to other strategic ways of getting strategic objectives done. It's done with a lighter footprint. There's less collateral damage. There still is collateral damage, and that's not to be underappreciated. That's terrible. But there are enemies out there, and they need to be dealt with. And we can either do it with boots on the ground, with Navy SEALs, with special ops teams, and that sort of thing, or we can do it with drone strikes.
Steve, we're running out of time, so let me get the panel to respond to you, and go ahead and stay on the line. Who wants to respond to Steve? Because this is an argument we hear a lot, that this is an alternative to traditional warfare that is relatively effective and that does produce fewer civilian casualties than traditional warfare.
I would argue that it's actually it's not what you would call an alternative to traditional warfare. I mean, there are some theaters where drones are used as a weapon alongside standard planes and other weapons, such as in Afghanistan and indeed in Iraq. But, for example, the drone campaign in Pakistan, there is not an alternative there of a traditional military campaign because of the political sensitivities of the country. For example, in Yemen, the reason that drones were first used in Yemen was that President Saleh insisted that military personnel could not enter the country, but he would permit... this was revealed in a WikiLeaks cable, so he would permit drones and air force and planes to fly outside the country and then to enter to carry out specific bombing raids. So this isn't a situation where... So the situations where drones are increasingly used and the situation where they're rightfully attracting the most attention, these are theatres where you couldn't have a conventional war without causing enormous, enormous extra costs. But that's not to say that drone strikes are necessarily preferable to other alternatives. You have to think, what would we have done 50 years ago with a state like Pakistan, where it is claimed there are significant numbers of terrorists hiding or being sheltered in Waziristan? you have to think that before drones were invented, before that technological alternative was available, we would have relied on diplomacy. America would have relied on diplomacy or on other means to get the job done.
And we are running out of time, so I want to get final thoughts from each of you. Jim in Santa Cruz says, bombing terrorists just makes more terrorists. I'm sorry we couldn't get to your call, Jim. Marion in Richmond says the human costs also include women and children. And Chris in El Sobrante says the issue goes back to Truman War. That's not war. So just we only have about 2 minutes remaining. Can you tell us what are your priorities in terms of questioning or changing policy around drones? And very briefly, let's start with you, John.
Well, the first issue, the primary issue from my point of view is Afghanistan. We're going to have a congressional debate over the timeline for withdrawal. And I think it's important for people to recognize that part of that discussion should include negotiations with the Taliban. Unfortunately, our drone policy right now is to target the very people that we should be negotiating with. So there I see that drone strikes are particularly counterproductive, and this is an area where we as citizens can enter into the debate in Congress on Afghanistan policy.
And thank you, John. And let's go to Noreen. Again, we only have a few seconds left.
I think what we want to do is make sure that drones don't become the norm. Drone strikes, secret drone strikes, don't become what this U.S. government does as a matter of default. There should be a lot more critical thinking about whether killing people as opposed to even acts of diplomacy or even interrogation and done in a humane way, whether those are the better alternatives.
And Alice?
To my mind, one of the key priorities specifically is investigating who has already been killed by these drone strikes, because if we can understand who is currently dying and who's currently killed, I think that will shape the way that we use these tools, or the way that the U.S. and other armies use these tools in future.
Well, and thank all of you for the work that you're doing on bringing some of these issues to light. A reminder that next week we will be talking about the domestic use of drones here in the United States. That's next Wednesday. And we've been talking about the international use of drones for targeted assassination with Alice Ross, who's a writer at the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. They just conducted a major investigation into the U.S. drone program. We'll put links to all of this at our website. Noreen Shaw is director of the Human Rights Clinic at the Columbia Law School, and John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. And we'll put links to all of that at yourcallradio.org. And you can also continue this conversation by commenting there. Again, that's yourcallradio.org. Thanks to everybody who joined us and for all of your calls and emails. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everything. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What's the future of museums? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Nina Simon, creator of the blog Museum 2.0. Museums are a labor of love, and they generally require subsidies. Many don't serve much of the population. Well, a budding movement hopes to turn museums into relevant and participatory spaces. So how do we make our museums more dynamic, relevant, essential resources? Join us at 10 for Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.